For those of you who may not know where you are and who you're with, my name is Ron Burke, and I am the Lutheran campus pastor at Southwest Texas State University in San Marcos, Texas, a little town between Austin and San Antonio. And the topic for the morning is chickens and dragons and geese. However, before we get into those, as you know, we'd have a short transition time for people who may be latecomers. And I'd like to add a fourth animal onto that, goats. Some random thoughts about goats. I like goats. As some of you have found out, my roots are in a Texas hill country ranch, and one of its prime assets has long been a herd of Angora goats. Angora goats being those that you share for mohair. My grandfather put the original herd of these goats together. My father kept them together, and now through the grace of inheritance, they are mine. And these goats have been good to me. I was a college and seminary student back during the drought-stricken 50s in Texas, a very, very tough time. And it was the hardy goat's ability to survive physically that enabled my rancher father to survive financially during that time, which in turn enabled him to help his student son stay in school. And the goats continue to be good to me financially as well as being a source of great pleasure. Nothing is more refreshing and relaxing for this sedentary, in quotes, shepherd than to take a few days off and to go play, as we call it in Texas, goat roper at the family ranch. And because of this deep affection that I have for goats, I must admit that I have a small quarrel with Jesus. Why did Jesus have to use the analogy of a shepherd separating the sheep from the goats in his mini sermon on the final judgment in Matthew 25? The older translations read, "And he will place the sheep at his right hand, but the goats at his left. And those on the right will then go to heaven, and those on the left will go to hell." And as a result of that one little story, goats have gotten a bad name. They have become associated with sinners. They become the bad guys of the Bible. And yet, why should innocent goats suffer for the sins of the people? We need to be reminded that Jesus is talking here about people and not goats. The newer translations make this clear. The Good News Bible translates Matthew 25:33. "He will put the righteous people at his right and the others at his left." No mention of goats at all. Pardon me. In fact, when the Bible does mention goats, it's usually in a favorable light. Goats were a recognized form of wealth in Bible times. They were the principal source of milk in Israel. They were a prime source of meat. Their hair was used for fabric. Goat hides were used for leather. And the famous wineskins of the Bible were made from whole goat skins. And one of the main Old Testament festivals was the Day of Atonement. And the star of that event was the scapegoat, who symbolically carried away the sins of the people. And there was even an aesthetic appreciation of goats. Proverbs 31:29-31 pays them this tribute. There are four things that are impressive to watch as they walk: lions, strutting roosters, kings in front of their people, and goats. And that classic love poem, Song of Songs, has the bridegroom say, "How beautiful you are, my love. Your hair dances like a flock of goats bounding down the hills of Gilead." So in spite of Matthew 25, the overall biblical image of goats is good. Not only do I like goats, I think God likes goats too.
One question.
In just a moment, sir. Yeah. I'm not through, sir. And in doing all this research, I am so impressed that I think I will have a picture taken of me and my son with our goats and have it entitled "The Father, the Son, and the Holy Goats." They will be in the middle. Now, your comment. I'm sorry.
My question is, if the
story of Jesus, separation of the goats, would that be the basis for the goat seems to be the mascot of the evil cult?
Yes, I choose not to do any negative research about goats, so I have nothing to comment about that. I only speak positive things about it. Yes, I think that's probably true. Goats also have a lusty reputation, which I think goes along with that too. But that's subject for Monday night's lecture. Pardon me?
In that vein, God asks Job if he knows the time of the goat, having consorted with them, son, do you?
I refuse to answer that question. Well, on to chickens, dragons, and geese, and a scriptural basis for what I would like to say following is Mark 2, verses 14 and following. As he, Jesus, walked along, he saw a tax collector, Levi, son of Alphaeus, sitting in his office. Jesus said to him, "Follow me." And Levi got up and followed him. Later on, Jesus was having a meal in Levi's house, and a large number of tax collectors and other outcasts was following Jesus, and many of them joined him and his disciples at the table. Some teachers of the law, who were Pharisees, saw that Jesus was eating with these outcasts and tax collectors, so they asked his disciples, "Why does he eat with such people?" Jesus heard them and answered, "People who are well do not need a doctor, but only those who are sick. I have not come to call respectable people, but outcasts." If you are like me, you hear a lot of regular complaints and criticisms about the church from people outside of the church. Complaints and criticisms about the Christian church in general, about the Lutheran church in general, and quite frequently about our own particular congregation, very specifically. And also, if you're like me, you will probably agree with many of these complaints and criticisms. I must admit that I am not perfectly content and happy with the way the church is today. And yet, because you are here at Holden Village on this bright, sunny summer day, I assume that you are also like me, and that in spite of all of these complaints and criticisms that you hear and that you have about the church, for some strange, weird, wild reason, we have not given up on the church. We stay in the church. Now, what is it that causes me and all of you to stay with this obviously flawed and imperfect institution called the church? Is it, as Frederick Buechner says, because the church is like Noah's Ark? If it weren't for the storm without, you could never stand the smell within. Or is it, as someone else has said, there are so many things wrong with the church, it takes a Christian to put up with it. Quite honestly, I'm not really sure why I stay with the church, but I think it has something to do with dragons and chickens and geese. My favorite story on dealing with criticism of the church is told by Will Campbell in his beautiful book, Brother to a Dragonfly. If you have not read that, I highly recommend it to you. Will Campbell was one of the speakers at the ALC National Youth Gathering a couple of years ago in Kansas City. Some of you may have been there and heard him and know something about him. For those of you who don't, Will Campbell can best be described as a renegade Southern Baptist preacher from Mississippi who has made it his life's work to minister to the outcast of society, to blacks as well as Ku Klux Klanners, to entertainers and prisoners. You name them, old Will has ministered to them. And this particular story relates an encounter with one of these people, an old friend of Will's by the name of P.D. East. And East was an outspoken maverick journalist who gained a certain amount of notoriety in the 60s by publishing a short-lived liberal publication in, of all places, Petal, Mississippi, called the Petal Paper. Now, I should tell you that Will tends to get a little earthy in his language at times, a fact which endures him to some but offends others, and not wanting this earthiness to be a stumbling block to keep some of you from hearing his message, I have taken the liberty of unearthing this story. A story that goes this way. Campbell says, when P.D. had his paper going, he liked to argue about religion. And most of it was satire, but I would often take it upon myself to set him straight on one theological point or another. He had long since deserted and disavowed the Methodist church of his foster parents and had tried being a Unitarian and had taken instruction from the local rabbi and was considering declaring himself a Jew. He referred to the church as the Easter Chicken. Each time I saw him, he would ask, "And what's the state of the Easter Chicken, Preacher Will?" I knew he was trying to goad me into some kind of an argument and decided just to wait him out. And one day he explained, "You know, Preacher Will, that church of yours and Mr. Jesus is like an Easter chicken my little Karen got one time. Man, it was a pretty thing, dyed a deep purple, bought it at the grocery store. And it served a real useful purpose. Karen loved it, made her happy, and that made me and her mama happy. But you know, pretty soon that baby chicken started feathering out, you know, sprouting little old pin feathers, wings and tail and all that. And you know what? Them new feathers weren't purple. No siree, Bob, that chicken wasn't really purple at all. That darn chicken was a Rhode Island red. And when all them little red feathers started growing out from under that purple, it was one heck of a sight. And all of a sudden, Karen couldn't stand that chicken no more. So we took that half-purple and half-red thing out to her grandma's house and threw it out in the chicken yard with all the other chickens. It was still different, you understand, that little chicken, and the other chickens, they knew it was different. And they resisted it like the devil, pecked it, chased it all over the yard, wouldn't have nothing to do with it. Wouldn't even let it get on the roost with them. And that little chicken, it knew it was different, too. It didn't bother any of the others, wouldn't fight back or anything, just stayed by itself. Pardon me, that's the hole in crud. But little by little, day by day, that chicken come around. Pretty soon, even before all the purple grew off of it, while it was still just a little bit different, that darn thing was behaving just about like the rest of them chickens. Man, it'd fight back, peck the devil out of the ones littler than it was, knock them down to catch a bug if it could get to it in time. Yes, sirree, Bob, that chicken world turned that Easter chicken around. And now you can't tell one chicken from another. They're all just alike. The Easter chicken is just one more chicken. There ain't a darn thing different about it. And then Campbell says, I knew he wanted to argue, and I didn't want to disappoint him, so I says, well, P.D., the Easter chicken is still useful. It lays eggs, doesn't it? Well, that was exactly what he wanted me to say. Yeah, Preacher Will, it lays eggs, but they all lay eggs. Who needs an Easter chicken for that? And the Rotary Club serves coffee, and the 4-H Club says prayers, and the Red Cross takes up offerings for hurricane victims, and mental health does counseling, and the Boy Scouts have youth programs. Well, I told him I agreed, and that it had been a long time since I would not have agreed, but that didn't have anything at all to do with the Christian faith. But he had a way of pushing one for simple answers, and he got a little bit hurt, and he asked me to define the Christian faith. And he said, now, you just tell me what this Jesus cat's all about. I'm not too bright, but maybe I can get the hang of it. Just keep it simple. In 10 words or less, what is the Christian message? Let me have it. 10 words. Then Campbell says, well, I thought a minute, and then I said, okay, we are all chickens, but God loves us anyway. Well, OPD thought about that for a minute, and then he asked me to say it again, and I repeated, we're all chickens, but God loves us anyway. PD didn't comment on what he thought about the summary, except to say, after he had counted the number of words on his fingers, I gave you a 10-word limit. If you want to try again, you got 2 words left. End of story. I like that story for a lot of reasons, but most of all because I think it's realistic. Campbell doesn't try to defend the church for what it is not. The fact is that the church is made up of a bunch of sinners. Church people aren't perfect. So why in the world should we expect the church organization to be perfect? And there's nothing wrong with that. I think it was George Farrell who said, I'm not okay, you're not okay, but that's okay. God knows our limitations. He knows our weaknesses. But he accepts us anyway. Annie Dillard, in her little book, Holy the Firm, tells about the little church that she attends near Puget Sound here in Washington. And she tells about their small and shoddy building, their membership of only about 20 people, their very mediocre minister, all in all, just a very plain, unimpressive organization. And yet, as she thinks about it, Dillard comes to the conclusion, nothing could more surely convince me of God's unending mercy than the continued existence on earth of the church. The plain fact is, the church is full of chickens, full of not perfect people, full of sinners. And the continued existence of this sinner-filled chicken coop is a powerful statement about God's mercy and about God's grace. So for the chickens, let's go on now to the dragons. And here I'd like to share another story with you, a story by Gordon Bennett. Ever feel like a dragon, huge, ugly, scaly, and fire-breathing? Then you know how the dragon felt that followed Debbie home. Hi, everybody, said Debbie that evening, pressing her nose against the screen door on the back porch. Her father grunted, her mother said supper was ready, and her dumplings were cold, and what took her so long coming home from the store, and she was just like a thirstin'. Look what followed me home, cried Debbie. They looked and looked and looked. Great Scott, yelled Daddy. Neato, screamed Jeff. And Mommy turned from the stove a second time. Why, it's only a dragon! That's right, Mommy. It's a big, ugly, scaly, fire-breathing dragon. He followed me home after I petted him a little. Can we keep him? The others cautiously peered through the door. I don't believe it, said Mommy. The dragon opened its mouth, and fire blackened the back porch. I'm a believer, she cried, beating a hasty retreat. Now, Debbie, that creature's dangerous. You come in and eat your dumplings like a nice 10-year-old while I call the SPCA. Wait, Mommy, said Debbie thoughtfully. According to the stories I've read, dragons can talk. Can you talk, dragon?
Of course, the dragon answered. Ever know one that couldn't?
Well, I really haven't met many dragons, but why did you follow me home?
You petted me. Nobody ever petted me before. Everybody hates me. I have this handicap, you see, and whenever I try to do anything nice, it always backfires.
You mean?
Yeah, if I try to light a man's cigar, I singe his whiskers. If I warm up a chicken coop, I burn the chickens and soft-boil the eggs. And nobody lets me work in their grocery stores because the ice cream always melts. It's a hard life being an ugly, scaly, fire-breathing dragon. I'd almost rather be human.
And the dragon lay down and put its head between its scaly green paws and wept. Daddy spoke up. Can't you put out your fire, you know, try drinking a swimming pool in one sitting? Or eat a great big jar of Alka-Seltzers? The dragon just moaned, nothing works. And he wept some more. Now, the family felt so sorry for the dragon that they lost their fear of it. Mommy and Daddy and Jeff went out into the backyard with Debbie, and they sat by the dragon, stroking it and petting it until at last the dragon's throat began to cool because the fire in its belly had gone out. The dragon opened its eyes wide in surprise.
Gee, I feel so much better. I think I got rid of my heartburn.
And the Thurstons all yelled, hooray! So that's how the dragon got over his handicap. After that, he stayed with the Thurstons and lived a very pleasant, useful life, painting landscapes and writing memoirs of his childhood when dragons were common on the earth. The dragon was still very scaly, but nobody thought he was ugly. And he still had bad breath. But nobody cared much about that either, as long as he stayed downwind, which he did most of the time. And he was loved by all. So, what is the task of the church? To find homes for dragons, of course. End of story. Ugly, scaly, fire-breathing dragons. The Charlie Browns, the Ziggies, the born losers. The world is full of such outcasts of society. Mark says some teachers of the law, who were Pharisees, saw that Jesus was eating with outcasts, so they asked the disciples, Why does he eat with outcasts? Jesus heard them and answered, "People who are well do not need a doctor, but only those who are sick. I have not come to call the respectable people, but the outcast." What is the task of the church? To find homes for dragons. There's an old story about a guy who was looking for a church home, and he had visited several churches only to hear the message loud and clear that church people were to be good and proper and pure and holy, and he knew that he didn't fit that description, so he kept right on looking. And one day, he entered a church a little bit late, shortly after the service had begun, and the people of that church were right in the middle of the confession at the words, "We have sinned against you in thought, word, and deed, by what we have done and by what we have left undone. We have not loved you with our whole heart. We have not loved our neighbors as ourselves." And as he heard these words, the seeker sank down into a pew with a sigh, saying, "Finally, my kind of people." One of my favorite definitions of the church is the church is not a museum for saints. It is a hospital for sinners. A church that fits that description, a church that is a hospital for sinners, a home for dragons, such a church makes a powerful statement about God's love and care. And now from dragons to geese. Philip Yancey, in his book with the delightful title Benedict Arnold Seagull, has this to say about geese. Geese don't get high-powered press coverage like seagulls. They're seen as dull, ordinary birds which only attract notice twice a year during migration. Like the Blue Angels, they fly wingtip to wingtip, and you can hear the beat of their wings whistling through the air in unison. And that is the secret of their strength. Together, cooperating as a flock, geese can fly a 71% longer range than can a solitary goose. The lead goose cuts a swath through the air resistance, which creates a helping uplift for the two birds immediately behind him. In turn, their beating makes it easier on the birds behind them, much like the drag of a race car sucked in behind the lead car. And each bird takes his turn at being the leader. The tired ones, they fan out to the edges of the V for a breather. And the rested ones, they surge forward towards the point of the V to drive the flock onward. And if a goose becomes too exhausted or ill and has to drop out of the flock, he is never abandoned. A stronger member of the flock will follow the falling weak one to his resting place and wait until he's well enough to fly again. Unquote. Commenting on this, a fellow by the name of Ralph Sturdy says, "Geese have taught me to fly in the church. I get support from other Christians when I fly in formation. As the entire formation flies, I fly with greater ease and farther than I ever could alone. I am reminded of my importance to the church because I am passing on a lift to the others in flight. Not only that, but I discover with support that it's all right to be a leader, and it is all right to support someone else as the leader. I cannot be content to be in only one role because my role is constantly changing. And one more thing, if I cannot make it with the group for some reason and need a rest, I will not be left to plunge from the sky alone, never to be spoken of or thought about again. In my weakness, I will get support from a stronger member of the family." Unquote. One of my favorite passages in the whole Bible is Ecclesiastes 4, verses 9 through 12. "Two are better off than one, because together they can work more effectively. If one of them falls down, the other can help him up. But if someone is alone and falls, it's just too bad because there's no one to help him. If it is cold, two can sleep together and stay warm. But how can you keep warm by yourself? Two men can resist an attack that would defeat one man alone. A rope made of three cords is hard to break. We need each other. We need the group. We need the family. We need the community. We need the church. We need this bunch of chickens and dragons, this communion of sinners. Martin Luther said that each Christian is a sinner and a saint at the same time. And this paradox of the individual Christian is also the paradox of the church. It is the communion of sinners. At the same time, it is the communion of saints. And by experiencing the grace and the care of God, this bunch of chickens, this bunch of dragons, becomes a flock of geese, sharing care and grace and love and mercy and hope with each other. A church that is like a flock of geese is a powerful statement about the transforming power of the love of God. So the church is full of chickens and dragons and geese. This has been true throughout its whole history, and it will undoubtedly be true for the rest of its history. So we might as well accept that fact. And with the acceptance of that fact, we can rejoice. Rejoice that God has mercy on chickens, provides a home for dragons, and gives us a flock of geese to fly with. And so for chickens and dragons and geese. Fly with that for a while. Would you care to share that with the whole group?
You want that?
Oh, yes, please share that with the whole group. Anyone care to comment or ask for clarification or anything? Do you agree, disagree?
Christ's statement that he was not here to minister to the respectable people. What do you make of that? What he's saying that the respectable people need no nurturing, or didn't need this much, or
I don't know. What do you think he meant? We're going to play that game.
Well, no, it's not that I have the answer and I'm holding it back. I'm curious about it.
Well, I think that's kind of what I was trying to say. I think basically my first reaction to that is that he is saying he has come to those people who realize that they need him. You can't really, let me lead up to this. You won't see any need of a doctor if you think you're well. If your car is running fine, you don't see any particular need for a mechanic. If you have no sins, what need do you have of a savior from sin? It would seem to me as if he is trying to say, it is those people who realize that they need me, who realize that they are sick and need a physician, a healer, it is those people that I have come to. That would be a brief answer to your question. Yes, ma'am.
Could it be that these other people already have him and have what they need, that the people he comes to serve, to minister to, are the people who don't have what these others have, and he wants to get them into that group for the other geese?
That could be a possible interpretation. He is speaking very directly to the Pharisees, you know, who really were a little bit snooty about their holiness. You know, they really thought they had it made and that they were holy, pure people. And I kind of hear him in a backhanded kind of way saying, you guys aren't as good as you think you are. And what scares me about that is if Jesus were to come today, I'm afraid I would be in the company of the Pharisees, of the establishment. That scares me.
Well, isn't that the dilemma of the church? I mean, isn't there sort of a constant impulse to be the respectable people? And on the other hand, you can't stay the outcast forever.
That's part of that paradox, which I think I mentioned that Luther is talking about when he says the Christian is a sinner and a saint at the same time. We all feel that tension, I think, within ourselves. There's a great little old cartoon from Peanuts where Lucy is trying to explain to Linus the human situation, and she draws a heart on the board, and she says, half of it's dark and half of it's black. And that's the human situation. All of us have our dark side and our light side, and they're constantly in tension. And Linus, the last panel, shows him great agony on his face and saying, yeah, I can feel him pulling right now, you know. I am constantly feeling that pull within me. You know, I'm a good person, but sometimes I'm a bad person, and that kind of bothers me. But that's the constant tension that, if we're honest, all of us must admit that we're in. And I think Jesus is saying, you're the kind of people I've come to help. If you recognize and will admit that you've got that side of you, I can help you get the other side stronger. Yes?
I think maybe we're getting caught up in words. I think perhaps more he was looking at piety and self-righteousness maybe than righteousness. Or establishment, because if you look back, he had friends in all sectors of society. It wasn't just the poor or the outcast or the ones that needed healing. My husband mentioned Lazarus, for instance. Wasn't he a very wealthy man? And that was one of his best friends, and he wept when he found out he had died. So I don't think it's so much establishment as maybe those who were self-righteous, who thought they were righteous by their own right, and who probably thought themselves better than others.
Yes, I'm sorry. I thought I was saying that, but evidently I didn't communicate that. By respectable, I don't mean wealthy or powerful or notorious people, anything like that. I meant in their religious piety or attitude towards themselves, yes. I think it's very easy, though, sometimes for us to immediately jump to that conclusion that if you are rich, wealthy, a success, you're automatically not among Jesus' friends. I don't think the Bible says that anywhere.
I really enjoyed what you had to say and your stories, and I wondered if you could say again with the books that you got them from and if they were available in the bookstore.
Okay, the first story is from Will Campbell's book, Brother to a Dragonfly. I'm not sure it's in the bookstore. I know it's in the library here. It's a beautiful story. It's sort of an autobiography of his struggles during the whole racial crisis in the South during the 60s. And a brother, his only brother, who he deeply loved, who was a pharmacist with a drug problem, who kept himself supplied with drugs. And it's a beautiful story of family tension, someone that you really love and care about trying to suffer with, or not trying, but suffering with them, and also suffering with the culture. Will Campbell's a native of Mississippi, and all of that cultural attitude that was there towards the blacks, and yet as a Christian, he really felt that he should live out the gospel message. And he was the National Council of Churches representative for race relations in the South during the whole 60s. Can you imagine a more unpopular position in the world? It's a beautiful book. He's an excellent writer. Second one, on the dragon, comes from a little book. I think it's out of print now. I don't even have the full title of it. But Gordon Bennett is the author, and it's something called Fables and Fairy Tales and something. They're really little choral readings designed to be that, and there's several in there. And then the last one, I didn't bring the book, I've been pushing in some of my contemplation and meditation sessions a little book called You by Mark Link. It is in the bookstore. And that one about the geese is in there. And that's an excellent little book for lots of resources. The goats comes from my column in the Southern Lutheran, the official newspaper of the Southern District of the ALC. And you can, I will sell you copies at $500 a piece. Now, if that sounds high, I know, but all I need to do is sell one, and I got it. Other questions or comments? Are you happy with the church?
I know I said in one of the classes earlier this week that I have become kind of disenchanted with, I'm all involved in the church, and the most of the programs, like at our church, we have a program for everybody, but they're only programs for people that are already there. And there, it seems to me the real meaning of what we're supposed to be for is to be reaching out to those unchurched. And although I know you need a balance, you need programs for the people that are there, but that can't be your only concentration. You need to be doing other things to be reaching out to that your community and being involved in that. And I don't think we are enough.
That's another tension that I constantly see in the church, is that it is a family, and we support each other. That's a very beautiful, a very necessary part of the church, but at the same time, it is not a closed family. It's not a closed clique. It's very close, but it's very open. And we constantly have that exhortation. You know, nowhere in the Bible, as somebody says, does it say that the world is to come into us. But a lot of places it says we are to go out to the world. Yes, we enjoy our hearth and home, but we also go out. And sometimes it's so warm and so comfortable at home that we forget to go out. Yes?
Well, like I've been, for the last 4 or 5 years, real involved in a lot of different activities, and I've kind of gotten saturated with, all of a sudden I think, although I, you know, like I said, think some of those programs are necessary, it kind of rubs me the wrong way that I don't think that we should need all of that, our own selfish attention, you know, for the people that are already there. And it really bothers me.
Would somebody care to comment about that? Yes.
You've got to look at what Christ did with the disciples. Remember, he spent a lot of time with them, constantly, all the time with them, coming back and nurturing them and so forth, because, you know, it seemed like for almost 2 years they missed the whole message. And they didn't really catch what was going on because it was all over with. So I think it's our responsibility to take care of the ones that are there and also to do like Ron's saying, reach out. The hard part about that reaching out, though, it's hard to buy that ugly-looking ticket, for one thing, and it's hard to go out and pet that dragon. See, that's the key to those first two things right there. If somebody had to buy that ugly-looking thing, first of all, and the second one is that little girl had to go pet the dragon first, or else the dragon would have never came home. It's easy to identify with the geese, because once you're in the church, I think we help each other. I think that's part of the system, and I think that's where we get it from. But I understand your frustration.
You know, you pet dragons, you run a pretty high risk of getting burnt. It's always a danger. Over here, and then back here.
Well, it seems to me, too, that in most churches, there are a few people that are extremely involved. It sounds like you're one of those. But really, a lot of the other people are not that involved. And I think a lot of the programs are switching out here to draw them into some kind of deeper involvement.
Okay.
This may be a little bit controversial, but sometimes I think that we focus too much on family, because I think that makes us think inclusively and what can we do, as she said, to meet our own needs. And I think oftentimes the programs in the church are more for the entertainment of Christians than they are for the nurturing and the strengthening and helping them to be strong to go out and pet the dragons. And I think that's one of my objections with what I see happening in the church now.
Okay. Anybody else care to jump in? We may just end up having a forum right here. Yes, sir.
One of the points I think we've skipped over on the first story, the chicken story, is the fellow's objection to the fact that all of the chickens lay eggs. If I might be allowed to allegorize what's only a parable, the egg is like the programs the church is laying all over the world. The things we do to keep ourselves busy and important. And there are so many other programs being developed by all of those other organizations out there. And what is the question that his point raises for me is, what does the church do that's unique? How does the church justify itself if it's just another organization laying eggs or putting out programs? Aren't we simply playing the world's game instead of doing our own?
As a minister of over 20 years, I've really wrestled with that. There was a time in my ministry when I said, I'm not going to do anything in my church or my campus ministry that is not obviously religious. So therefore, why have a church softball team? Why have suppers and all that kind of stuff? Let's keep to preaching and teaching the word and that kind of thing. Well, then I went through a stage where I found out that that was a little bit narrow-minded, to say the least. And I got almost to the other extreme where I was doing a lot of playing volleyball and having couples clubs, progressive dinners, and that kind of thing. And found, and now I'm kind of back at an in-between thing. And I guess what I have discovered is that which comes first, the chicken or the egg, if we're going to stay with that kind of analogy. I think that the church is a family. I don't think we can ignore that. It is a communion of saints, the fellowship of believers. And there's nothing more lonely or frustrating than going to a family reunion and not being a part of that family. I don't think you can really understand what that family reunion, that family celebration is all about unless you are a member of the family. So therefore, I'm one of those who feels that the poorest form of evangelism is to invite people to come to worship with you. Because you're inviting them to come to a family reunion where they're not a member of the family and they're going to feel like an outsider and they're not going to understand what's going on, etc., etc., etc. I feel, and I think there's some example in the early church of you went through a probation time. You know, they actually, as I understand it, you know, if you weren't a member of the church, you couldn't even really go to worship. That you first of all get to know the family and what they're all about. And in modern day terms, I think the way you do that is through some of these very purely social events. You meet people in an unthreatening, comfortable situation. You get to know them, and you begin to say, hey, these people have got something that I like, that I'm interested in. And you start thinking more about that, and then you go in. I have seen so many people come out of softball or basketball or volleyball and go, the next step is to go to a Sunday school or a Bible study or class, and then the next step, they end up in an instruction class, and then they end up as members of the church involved in the whole family. It seems to me as if that is kind of a natural process for getting people into the family, a natural process of evangelism. So that's kind of where I am now. Now, I must admit that in campus ministry, my current philosophy of programming is that I do almost nothing other than parties and some things like that are not obviously religious, because on our particular campus there are, you know, great world lecturers coming in, there are films, there are concerts, there are all kinds of classes on, you know, a lot of the things we've been talking about are emphasizing here on how to deal with the third world and simple lifestyle and things of that nature. There are people in my community, campus community, who are doing that much better than I could ever hope to do.
But there's nobody on our campus other than the religious organizations who are obviously doing religious things. We are the only ones doing worship. And as a counselor friend of mine told me this last semester, really, really pinned it down for me, he said, you know, we have students coming to us all the time for counseling and help. And we can do them a lot of good and a lot of help. But there's one thing we cannot do that only you can do, and that is pronounce forgiveness to them. Tell them they are forgiven. And that's really what they're all looking for. Well, I'm almost off on another lecture, but that's kind of my way with wrestling with this tension. I don't know whether it's helpful to you or not, and I think that has to be interpreted in every place in an individual way, but that's what one person has wrestled with, that tension. What are some of the things you like about the church? Let's get into it. Why do you stay in the church? I assume everybody here is a member of the church. Why do you stay? Why do you stay in the church? I'm glad to hear you say that. That's an ideal which I'm not sure is always respected, that in a family you don't all have to agree. You can have different points of view, but you still are part of the family and love each other and respect the other person's opinion. I hope that happens in the church, but I see a lot of people saying, well, if you don't agree with me, then get out. Or, if you don't agree with me, I'll get out. Or, as was brought up somewhere the other day, or I won't send any money, I'll just quit giving. I'm sure nobody in here has ever thought that. Sir?
Kirkwood Fantech.
Yeah, that's where that discussion came up. Wasn't it? Yeah. It's all right for us to boycott, but we don't like for them to boycott. Yeah, it's a dilemma.
What should you do if you see?
That's a very real question that I hear lots of people say. Lots of students come to me and say, you know, my needs are not being met in the church. That's why I'm pulling out of it. That's the most common reaction, I think, is for people just, well, to fade away. Yes?
I think we get that frequently. It's frustrating when we, if you are involved in an organization of the church, when we try to get people involved, recruit them to teach Sunday school, sing the choir, or do these types of things, a lot of people have a misconception of what they are going to get out of the church. You know, I'm not getting what I want from this group, therefore I'm going to go someplace else that strikes me in the right way. I think we have to get at exactly, you know, what is the organization of the church and what can you give to it. And we always try to face in our church of opportunities rather than obligations. So I guess I would try to emphasize to the person that it's not what you get out, that we are always a giving, sacrificing church and organization.
I'm not sure how many of you were here for Mary Schramm's presentation on, what does she call it, evoking gifts, discerning gifts. If you weren't, she has her book over there, The Gifts of Grace, and really gets into that, I think, beautifully, of the idea that people within the church discerning their own, or discovering their own, their each individual gifts, and then sharing those in the community of the church, and that the church should be open enough to allow that. That beautiful story that she and John both tell about the guy who decided his gifts were building model airplanes, and lo and behold, here comes this opportunity to minister through building model airplanes. But the church too often tries to say, okay, we, you know, you get one of those pledge sheets. You know, are you willing to serve as an usher on the church council, altar guild, you know, all those kinds of things, Sunday school teachers and all that stuff. But we don't have a place to build model airplanes and so forth and so on. Maybe that's a little restrictive.
We have a hard time putting that on our computer.
Yeah.
We don't have a number for it, but we do have a number for other skills.
Oh, other skills.
Feel not aware.
Okay.
I think yes. The more you give, the more you receive. If you're not receiving, then there's something wrong with you.
Would you say that again?
I think the more you give to the church, the more you give of yourself to the church, the more you get back in so many different ways. Blessings of all kinds, fellowships, and just so many things. But if you're not getting from the church, you better look within yourself first.
Would you agree or disagree with that?
I think to a extent, but not maybe totally. You know, a lot of people can but you know, there's a point where people can end up they are giving a lot more than they need to give. So it turns into a negative instead of a positive.
The danger of this, and I tend to basically agree with that, but the danger of going with that philosophy is, okay, I'm only going to give so that I will get. It's an investment. It's a financial arrangement. And I think that's preached a lot in our society today. And I know lots of people who are sure giving a whole lot and all they're getting is a cross. That's what they get in return. And a lot of people don't like that. And that's why a lot of people pull out. So basically, yeah.
I don't mean that you're giving to get, but that just comes.
Yeah, okay, but I'm saying that there is a danger when you start saying that some people will hear that as a, quote, investment kind of thing. And we have to be a little bit careful how we say that. Yes?
It's hard sometimes to be that leader in the flock of geese and then try and fly back a little bit because you're tired and find no support. That has happened also.
Yep. Yes.
I was going to say another one of the difficult things I think that might be frustrating to people that have been very active is when we expect that other people are going to be as active or more active when we ask them. In other words, they are not at the point wherever we may be, and it's frustrating when we expect just as much from others. But we should understand that people are at different levels in their understanding of the church or in what they feel that they can contribute. You know, how many times have you gone to someone that you know can do this job? They're just right for it. They've done it in other facets of their professional life. And for some reason, they turn you down. It's frustrating that that a person cannot convince or to show what a great opportunity this is. And I think maybe that is frustrating to some people that have been involved in the church.
If I may speak as a pastor, who is also a member of a congregation, that's one of the unique roles that I play, is I sit in the pew as often as I stand in the pulpit, and nothing, every minister should be sentenced to sit in the pew frequently. You really begin to see some of the dilemmas of the pewees, as I call them, the pew dwellers. And we got caught, I assume this tape will not get back to San Marcos, Texas, but we got caught in a dilemma like this a little over a year ago when we had a pastor who was a very nice guy, but he was a lousy pastor. That's just as blunt as you can say it. And he was just not doing his job, either from the pulpit or any other way. And yet nobody in the congregation was courageous enough to confront him with this. And one of the biggest complaints was that he was just a lousy preacher. And it's my practice to stay out of the running of our congregation because I don't want the pastor down running my campus ministry. And that's just been a working policy for me. But it finally got to the point that I could not go to any kind of social event or anything where they didn't serve roast pastor, and that bothered me. And finally I felt that it was my Christian duty as a brother to go to this guy and just share with him the feedback that I was getting. And so I did. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life, to go in and confront this guy with that. And the most surprising thing about that was that at least what he, his reaction was that everything I told him was complete news to him. He had no idea at all of this dissatisfaction. And the most frightening thing to me was when I said, you know, some sort of feedback there, some honest feedback. More and more congregations are having the, well, they go by various names, basically a pastoral relations committee that has no power whatsoever. It's just some people that the congregation trusts and some people that the pastor trusts, and they get together regularly and just give feedbacks. The people tell the pastor kind of what they're hearing among other people, and the pastor kind of dumps on them, you know, these are some of my frustrations with you people. And that kind of dialogue, I think, can be very helpful. I guess what I'm trying to say in answer to this is I think, as a pastor, that quite frequently the whole mood of a congregation is set by the pastor. That's, we cannot ignore that fact, no matter how much we think of the church as being lay leaders and all that kind of thing. The pastor sets the mood, and quite frequently he sets the wrong mood, and somehow we need to work that out, give feedback and dialogue, and you, the lay people, need to minister to the pastor just as much as he ministers to you, if we are really a family.
What happened to your church?
Well, the rather interesting thing was that this guy really didn't believe me. And he stayed around. And finally, I went back to him again, and I've never done this before, and I thought I would never do it. I finally told him, I said, you know, I think you should leave. For your sake and the congregation's sake, you walk away from here, and you can hold your head held high, and you can get another job, and, you know, just all that kind of stuff. And you'll leave his friends and everything else. If you stay, it's going to end up in a mess. And he stayed, and it ended up in a mess, and they got rid of him. And rather fortunately, with a minimum amount of scars, it came out at a congregational meeting, and it just started mushrooming. One guy got up and started saying things, and lo and behold, 90% of the people had the same feelings, and it got aired. And anyway, he is gone, and now we have a great pastor. Not perfect, but a lot of these things happen. It worked out fine, but not without a crisis situation. And now I'm staying out of things again, and I hope I never have to get back involved. But.